and the scheme suggested may be assumed to have been very likely to succeed. Socrates, however, would have none of it. He contended that he had been condemned by due process of law, and that it would be wrong to do anything illegal to avoid punishment. He first proclaimed the principle which we associate with the Sermon on the Mount, that we ought not to retaliate evil for evil to anyone, whatever evil we may have suffered from him. He then imagines himself engaged in a dialogue with the lords of Athens, in which they point out that he owes them the kind of respect that a son owes to a father or a slave to his master, but in an even higher degree, and that, moreover, every Athenian citizen is free to emigrate if he dislikes the Athenian state. The laws end a long speech with the words, "Listen then, Socrates, to us who have brought you up. Think not of life and children first, and of justice afterwards, but of justice first, that you may be justified before the princes of the world below. For neither will you, nor any that belong to you, be happier or holier or juster in this life, or happier in another, if you do as Crito bids. Now you depart in innocence, a sufferer, and not a doer of evil, a victim not of the laws, but of men. But if you go forth returning evil for evil, and injury for injury, breaking the covenants and agreements which you have made with us, and wronging those whom you ought least of all to wrong, that is to say, yourself, your friends, your country, and us, we shall be angry with you while you live, and our brethren, the laws in the world below, will receive you as an enemy, for they will know that you have done your best to destroy us." This voice, Socrates says, I seem to hear humming in my ears, like the sound of the flute in the ears of the mystic. He decides accordingly that it is his duty to stay and abide the death sentence. In the Phaedo, the last hour has come, his chains are taken off, and he is allowed to converse freely with his friends. He sends away his weeping wife in order that her grief may not interfere with the discussion. Socrates begins by maintaining that though anyone who has the spirit of philosophy will not fear death, but on the contrary will welcome it, yet he will not take his own life, for that is held to be unlawful. His friends inquire why suicide is held to be unlawful, and his answer, which is in accordance with Orphic doctrine, is almost exactly what a Christian might say. There is a doctrine whispered in secret that man is a prisoner who has no right to open the door and run away. This is a great mystery which I do not quite understand. He compares the relation of man to God with that of cattle to their owner. You would be angry, he says, if your ox took the liberty of putting himself out of the way, and so there may be reason in saying that a man should wait and not take his own life until God summons him, as he is now summoning me. He is not grieved at death, because he is convinced, in the first place, that I am going to other gods who are wise and good, of which I am as certain as I can be of any such matters, and secondly, though I am not so sure of this last, to men departed, better than those whom I leave behind. I have good hope that there is yet something remaining for the dead, some far better thing for the good than for the evil. Death, says Socrates, is the separation of soul and body. Here we come upon Plato's dualism, between reality and appearance, ideas and sensible objects, reason and sense perception, soul and body. These pairs are connected. The first in each pair is superior to the second, both in reality and in goodness. An ascetic morality was the natural consequence of this dualism. Christianity adopted this doctrine in part, but never wholly. There were two obstacles. The first was that the creation of the visible world, if Plato was right, must have been an evil deed, and therefore the creator could not be good. The second was that Orthodox Christianity could never bring itself to condemn marriage, though it held celibacy to be nobler. The Manichaeans were more consistent in both respects. The distinction between mind and matter, which has become a commonplace in philosophy and science and popular thought, has a religious origin, and began as the distinction of soul and body. The Orphic, as we saw, proclaims himself the child of earth and of the starry heaven. From earth comes the body, from heaven the soul. It is this theory that Plato seeks to express in the language of philosophy. Socrates, in the Phaedo, proceeds at once to develop the ascetic implications of his doctrine, but his asceticism is of a moderate and gentlemanly sort. He does not say that the philosopher should wholly abstain from ordinary pleasures, but only that he should not be a slave to them. The philosopher should not care about eating and drinking, but of course he should eat as much as is necessary. There is no suggestion of fasting. And we are told that Socrates, though indifferent to wine, could on occasion drink more than anybody else without ever becoming intoxicated. It was not drinking that he condemned, but pleasure in drinking. In like manner, the philosopher must not care for the pleasures of love, or for costly raiment, or sandals, or other adornments of the person. He must be entirely concerned with the soul and not with the body. He would like, as far as he can, to get away from the body and to turn to the soul. It is obvious that this doctrine, popularized, would become ascetic, but in intention it is not, properly speaking, ascetic. The philosopher will not abstain with an effort from the pleasures of sense, but will be thinking of other things. I have known many philosophers who forgot their meals and read a book when at last they did eat. These men were acting as Plato says they should. They were not abstaining from gluttony by means of a moral effort, but were more interested in other matters. Apparently the philosopher should marry and beget and rear children in the same absent-minded way. But since the emancipation of women, this has become more difficult. No wonder Xantippe was a shrew. Philosophers, Socrates continues, try to dissever the soul from communion with the body, whereas other people think that life is not worth living for a man who has no sense of pleasure and no part in bodily pleasure. In this phrase, Plato seems, perhaps inadvertently, to countenance the view of a certain class of moralists, that bodily pleasures are the only ones that count. These moralists hold that the man who does not seek the pleasures of sense must be eschewing pleasures altogether and living virtuously. This is an error which has done untold harm. Insofar as the division of mind and body can be accepted, the worst pleasures, as well as the best, are mental. For example, envy and many forms of cruelty and love of power. Milton's Satan rises superior to physical torment and devotes himself to a work of destruction from which he derives a pleasure that is wholly of the mind. Many eminent ecclesiastics, having renounced the pleasures of sense and being not on their guard against others, became dominated by love of power, which led them to appalling cruelties and persecutions, nominally for the sake of religion. In our own day, Hitler belongs to this type. By all accounts, the pleasures of sense are of very little importance to him. Liberation from the tyranny of the body contributes to greatness, but just as much to greatness in sin as to greatness in virtue. This, however, is a digression from which we must return to Socrates. We come now to the intellectual aspect of the religion which Plato, rightly or wrongly, attributes to Socrates. We are told that the body is a hindrance in the acquisition of knowledge, and that sight and hearing are inaccurate witnesses. True existence, if revealed to the soul at all, is revealed in thought, not in sense. Let us consider for a moment the implications of this doctrine. It involves a complete rejection of empirical knowledge, including all history and geography. We cannot know that there was such a place as Athens or such a man as Socrates. His death and his courage in dying belong to the world of appearance. It is only through sight and hearing that we know anything about all this, and the true philosopher ignores sight and hearing. What then is left to him? First, logic and mathematics. But these are hypothetical and do not justify any categorical assertion about the real world. The next step, and this is the crucial one, depends upon the idea of the good. Having arrived at this idea, the philosopher is supposed to know that the good is real, and thus to be able to infer that the world of ideas is the real world. Later philosophers had arguments to prove the identity of the real and the good, but Plato seems to have assumed it as self-evident. If we wish to understand him, we must, hypothetically, suppose this assumption justified. Thought is best, Socrates says, when the mind is gathered into itself and is not troubled by sounds or sights or pain or pleasure, but takes leave of the body and aspires after true being. And in this the philosopher dishonors the body. From this point, Socrates goes on to the ideas or forms or essences. There is absolute justice, absolute beauty, and absolute good, but they are not visible to the eye. And I speak not of these alone, but of absolute greatness and health and strength, and of the essence or true nature of everything. All these are only to be seen by intellectual vision. Therefore, while we are in the body, and while the soul is infected with the evils of the body, our desire for truth will not be satisfied. This point of view excludes scientific observation and experiment as methods for the attainment of knowledge. The experimenter's mind is not gathered into itself, and does not aim at avoiding sounds or sights. The two kinds of mental activity that can be pursued by the method that Plato recommends are mathematics and mystic insight. This explains how these two come to be so intimately combined in Plato and the Pythagoreans. To the empiricist, the body is what brings us into touch with the world of external reality. But to Plato, it is doubly evil, as a distorting medium, causing us to see as through a glass darkly, and as a source of lusts which distract us from the pursuit of knowledge and the vision of truth. Some quotations will make this clear. The body is the source of endless trouble to us by reason of the mere requirement of food, and is liable also to diseases which overtake and impede us in the search after true being. It fills us full of loves and lusts and fears and fancies of all kinds, and endless foolery, and in fact, as men say, takes away from us all power of thinking at all. Whence come wars and fightings and factions? Whence but from the body and the lusts of the body? Wars are occasioned by the love of money, and money has to be acquired for the sake and in the service of the body. And by reason of all these impediments, we have no time to give to philosophy. And last and worst of all, even if we are at leisure to betake ourselves to some speculation, the body is always breaking in upon us, causing turmoil and confusion in our inquiries, and so amazing us that we are prevented from seeing the truth. It has been proved to us by experience that if we would have true knowledge of anything, we must be quit of the body. The soul in herself must behold things in themselves, and then we shall attain the wisdom which we desire, and of which we say we are lovers, not while we live, but after death. For if, while in company with the body, the soul cannot have pure knowledge, knowledge must be attained after death, if at all. And thus, having got rid of the foolishness of the body, we shall be pure and have converse with the pure and know of ourselves the clear light everywhere, which is no other than the light of truth. For the impure are not permitted to approach the pure. And what is purification but the separation of the soul from the body? And this separation and release of the soul from the body is termed death. And the true philosophers, and they only, are ever seeking to release the soul. There is one true coin for which all things ought to be exchanged, and that is wisdom. The founders of the mysteries would appear to have had a real meaning and were not talking nonsense when they intimated in a figure long ago that he who passes unsanctified and uninitiated into the world below will lie in a slough, but that he who arrives there after initiation and purification will dwell with the gods. For many, as they say in the mysteries, are the thyrsus-bearers, but few are the mystics, meaning, as I interpret the words, the true philosophers. All this language is mystical and is derived from the mysteries. Purity is an Orphic conception, having primarily a ritual meaning, but for Plato it means freedom from slavery to the body and its needs. It is interesting to find him saying that wars are caused by love of money, and that money is only needed for the service of the body. The first half of this opinion is the same as that held by Marx, but the second belongs to a very different outlook. Plato thinks that a man could live on very little money if his wants were reduced to a minimum, and this no doubt is true. But he also thinks that a philosopher should be exempt from manual labor. He must therefore live on wealth created by others. In a very poor state, there are likely to be no philosophers. It was the imperialism of Athens in the age of Pericles that made it possible for Athenians to study philosophy. Speaking broadly, intellectual goods are just as expensive as more material commodities, and just as little independent of economic conditions. Science requires libraries, laboratories, telescopes, microscopes, and so on, and men of science have to be supported by the labor of others. But to the mystic, all this is foolishness. A holy man in India or Tibet needs no apparatus, wears only a loincloth, eats only rice, and is supported by very meagre charity because he is thought wise. This is the logical development of Plato's point of view. To return to the Phaedo, Cebes expresses doubts as to the survival of the soul after death and urges Socrates to offer arguments. This he proceeds to do, but it must be said that the arguments are very poor. The first argument is that all things which have opposites are generated from their opposites, a statement which reminds us of Anaximander's views on cosmic justice. Now life and death are opposites, and therefore each must generate the other. It follows that the souls of the dead exist somewhere and come back to earth in due course. St. Paul's statement, "The seed is not quickened except it die," seems to belong to some such theory as this. The second argument is that knowledge is recollection, and therefore the soul must have existed before birth. The theory that knowledge is recollection is supported chiefly by the fact that we have ideas, such as exact equality, which cannot be derived from experience. We have experience of approximate equality, but absolute equality is never found among sensible objects, and yet we know what we mean by absolute equality. Since we have not learnt this from experience, we must have brought the knowledge with us from a previous existence. A similar argument, he says, applies to all other ideas. Thus, the existence of essences and our capacity to apprehend them proves the pre-existence of the soul with knowledge. The contention that all knowledge is reminiscence is developed at greater length in the Meno, 82 and following. Here Socrates says, "There is no teaching but only recollection." He professes to prove his point by having Meno call in a slave boy, whom Socrates proceeds to question on geometrical problems. The boy's answers are supposed to show that he really knows geometry, although he has hitherto been unaware of possessing this knowledge. The same conclusion is drawn in the Meno as in the Phaedo, that knowledge is brought by the soul from a previous existence. As to this, one may observe in the first place that the argument is wholly inapplicable to empirical knowledge. The slave boy could not have been led to remember when the pyramids were built or whether the siege of Troy really occurred unless he had happened to be present at these events. Only the sort of knowledge that is called a priori, especially logic and mathematics, can be possibly supposed to exist in every one independently of experience. In fact, this is the only sort of knowledge, apart from mystic insight, that Plato admits to be really knowledge. Let us see how the argument can be met in regard to mathematics. Take the concept of equality. We must admit that we have no experience among sensible objects of exact equality. We see only approximate equality. How then do we arrive at the idea of absolute equality, or do we perhaps have no such idea? Let us take a concrete case. The meter is defined as the length of a certain rod in Paris at a certain temperature. What should we mean if we said of some other rod that its length was exactly 1 meter? I don't think we should mean anything. We could say, the most accurate processes of measurement known to science at the present day fail to show that our rod is either longer or shorter than the standard meter in Paris. We might, if we were sufficiently rash, add a prophecy that no subsequent refinements in the technique of measurement will alter this result. But this is still an empirical statement, in the sense that empirical evidence may at any moment disprove it. I do not think we really possess the idea of absolute equality that Plato supposes us to possess. But even if we do, it is clear that no child possesses it until it reaches a certain age, and that the idea is elicited by experience, although not directly derived from experience. Moreover, unless our existence before birth was not one of sense perception, it would have been as incapable of generating the idea as this life is, and if our previous existence is supposed to have been partly supersensible, why not make the same supposition concerning our present existence? On all these grounds, the argument fails. The doctrine of reminiscence being considered established, Cebes says, about half of what was required has been proven, to wit, that our souls existed before we were born. That the soul will exist after death as well as before birth is the other half of which the proof is still wanting. Socrates accordingly applies himself to this. He says that it follows from what was said about everything being generated from its opposite, according to which death must generate life just as much as life generates death. But he adds another argument, which had a longer history in philosophy, that only what is complex can be dissolved, and that the soul, like the ideas, is simple and not compounded of parts. What is simple, it is thought, cannot begin or end or change. Now, essences are unchanging. Absolute beauty, for example, is always the same, whereas beautiful things continually change. Thus, things seen are temporal, but things unseen are eternal. The body is seen, but the soul is unseen. Therefore, the soul is to be classified in the group of things that are eternal. The soul, being eternal, is at home in the contemplation of eternal things, that is, essences, but is lost and confused when, as in sense perception, it contemplates the world of changing things. The soul, when using the body as an instrument of perception, that is to say, when using the sense of sight or hearing or some other sense, for the meaning of perceiving through the body is perceiving through the senses, is then dragged by the body into the region of the changeable, and wanders, and is confused. The world spins round her, and she is like a drunkard when she touches change. But when returning into herself, she reflects, then she passes into the other world, the region of purity and eternity and immortality and unchangeableness, which are her kindred, and with them she ever lives when she is by herself and is not let or hindered. Then she ceases from her erring ways, and being in communion with the unchanging is unchanging, and this state of the soul is called wisdom. The soul of the true philosopher, which has in life been liberated from thraldom to the flesh, will after death depart to the invisible world, to live in bliss in the company of the gods. But the impure soul, which has loved the body, will become a ghost haunting the sepulchre, or will enter into the body of an animal, such as an ass or wolf or hawk, according to its character. A man who has been virtuous without being a philosopher will become a bee or wasp or ant, or some other animal of a gregarious and social sort. Only the true philosopher goes to heaven when he dies. No one who has not studied philosophy and who is not entirely pure at the time of his departure is allowed to enter the company of the gods, but the lover of knowledge only. That is why the true votaries of philosophy abstain from fleshly lusts, not that they fear poverty or disgrace, but because they are conscious that the soul was simply fastened or glued to the body. Until philosophy received her, she could only view real existence through the bars of a prison, not in and through herself, and by reason of lust had become the principal accomplice in her own captivity. The philosopher will be temperate because each pleasure and pain is a sort of nail, which nails and rivets the soul to the body, until she becomes like the body, and believes that to be true which the body affirms to be true. At this point, Simmias brings up the Pythagorean opinion that the soul is a harmony, and urges, if the lyre is broken, can the harmony survive? Socrates replies that the soul is not a harmony, for a harmony is complex, but the soul is simple. Moreover, he says, the view that the soul is a harmony is incompatible with its pre-existence, which was proved by the doctrines of reminiscence, for the harmony does not exist before the lyre. Socrates proceeds to give an account of his own philosophical development, which is very interesting, but not germane to the main argument. He goes on to expound the doctrine of ideas, leading to the conclusion that ideas exist and that other things participate in them and derive their names from them. At last he describes the fate of souls after death, the good to heaven, the bad to hell, the intermediate to purgatory. His end and his farewells are described. His last words are, Crito, I owe a cock to Asclepius, will you remember to pay the debt? Men paid a cock to Asclepius when they recovered from an illness, and Socrates has recovered from life's fitful fever. Of all the men of his time, Phaedo concludes, he was the wisest and justest and best. The Platonic Socrates was a pattern to subsequent philosophers for many ages. What are we to think of him ethically? I am concerned only with a man as Plato portrays him. His merits are obvious. He is indifferent to worldly success, so devoid of fear that he remains calm and urbane and humorous to the last moment, caring more for what he believes to be truth than for anything else whatever. He has, however, some very grave defects. He is dishonest and sophistical in argument, and in his private thinking he uses intellect to prove conclusions that are to him agreeable, rather than in a disinterested search for knowledge. There is something smug and unctuous about him, which reminds one of a bad type of cleric. His courage in the face of death would have been more remarkable if he had not believed that he was going to enjoy eternal bliss in the company of the gods. Unlike some of his predecessors, he was not scientific in his thinking, but was determined to prove the universe agreeable to his ethical standards. This is treachery to truth, and the worst of philosophic sins. As a man, we may believe him admitted to the communion of saints, but as a philosopher, he needs a long residence in a scientific purgatory. Chapter 18. Plato's Cosmogony. Plato's cosmogony is set forth in the Timaeus, which was translated into Latin by Cicero and was, in consequence, the only one of the dialogues that was known in the West in the Middle Ages. Both then and earlier in Neoplatonism, it had more influence than anything else in Plato, which is curious, as it certainly contains more that is simply silly than is to be found in his other writings. As philosophy, it is unimportant, but historically it was so influential that it must be considered in some detail. The place, occupied by Socrates in the earlier dialogues, is taken in the Timaeus by a Pythagorean, and the doctrines of that school are in the main adopted, including the view that number is the explanation of the world. There is first a summary of the first five books of the Republic, then the myth of Atlantis, which is said to have been an island off the Pillars of Hercules, larger than Libya and Asia put together. Then Timaeus, who is a Pythagorean astronomer, proceeds to tell the history of the world down to the creation of man. What he says is in outline as follows. What is unchanging is apprehended by intelligence and reason. What is changing is apprehended by opinion. The world, being sensible, cannot be eternal, and must have been created by God. Since God is good, he made the world after the pattern of the eternal. Being without jealousy, he wanted everything as like himself as possible. God desired that all things should be good and nothing bad as far as possible. Finding the whole visible sphere not at rest, but moving in an irregular and disorderly fashion, out of disorder he brought order. Thus it appears that Plato's God, unlike the Jewish and Christian God, did not create the world out of nothing, but rearranged pre-existing material. He put intelligence in the soul, and the soul in the body. He made the world as a whole a living creature having soul and intelligence. There is only one world, not many, as various pre-Socratics had taught. There cannot be more than one, since it is a created copy, designed to accord as closely as possible with the eternal original apprehended by God. The world in its entirety is one visible animal, comprehending within itself all other animals. It is a globe because like is fairer than unlike, and only a globe is alike everywhere. It rotates because circular motion is the most perfect, and since this is its only motion, it needs no feet or hands. The four elements, fire, air, water, and earth, each of which apparently is represented by a number, are in continued proportion. That is, fire is to air is to water, and as water is to earth. God used all the elements in making the world, and therefore it is perfect, and not liable to old age or disease. It is harmonized by proportion, which causes it to have the spirit of friendship, and therefore to be indissoluble except by God. God made first the soul, then the body. The soul is compounded of the indivisible unchangeable and the divisible changeable. It is a third and intermediate kind of essence. Here follows a Pythagorean account of the planets, leading to an explanation of the origin of time. When the Father and Creator saw the creature which he had made moving and living, the created image of the eternal gods, he rejoiced, and in his joy determined to make the copy still more like the original. And as this was eternal, he sought to make the universe eternal, so far as it might be. Now the nature of the ideal being was everlasting, but to bestow this attribute and its fullness upon a creature was impossible. Wherefore he resolved to have a moving image of eternity, and when he set in order the heaven, he made this image eternal, but moving according to number, while eternity itself rests in unity, and this image we call time. Footnote. Vaughan must have been reading this passage when he wrote the poem beginning, I saw eternity the other night. End of footnote. Before this, there were no days or nights. Of the eternal essence, we must not say that it was or will be, only is correct. It is implied that of the moving image of eternity, it is correct to say that it was and will be. Time and the heavens came into existence at the same instant. God made the sun so that animals could learn arithmetic. Without the succession of days and nights, one supposes, we should not have thought of numbers. The sight of day and night, months and years, has created knowledge of number and given us the conception of time, and hence came philosophy. This is the greatest boon we owe to sight. There are, apart from the world as a whole, four kinds of animals: gods, birds, fishes, and land animals. The gods are mainly fire. The fixed stars are divine and eternal animals. The Creator told the gods that he could destroy them, but would not do so. He left it to them to make the mortal part of all the other animals, after he had made the immortal and divine part. This, like other passages about the gods in Plato, is perhaps not to be taken very seriously. At the beginning, Timaeus says he seeks only probability and cannot be sure. Many details are obviously imaginative and not meant literally. The Creator, Timaeus says, made one soul for each star. Souls have sensation, love, fear, and anger. If they overcome these, they live righteously. But if not, not. If a man lives well, he goes after death to live happily forever in his star. But if he lives badly, he will in the next life be a woman. If he or she persists in evil doing, he or she will become a brute and go on through transmigrations until at last reason conquers. God put some souls on earth, some on the moon, some on other planets and stars, and left it to the gods to fashion their bodies. There are two kinds of causes, those that are intelligent and those that, being moved by others, are in turn compelled to move others. The former are endowed with mind and are the workers of things fair and good, while the latter produce chance effects without order or design. Both sorts ought to be studied, for the creation is mixed, being made up of necessity and mind. It will be observed that necessity is not subject to God's power. Timaeus now proceeds to deal with the part contributed by necessity. Earth, air, fire, and water are not the first principles or letters or elements. They are not even syllables or first compounds. Fire, for instance, should not be called this, but such. That is to say, it is not a substance, but rather a state of substance. At this point, the question is raised, are intelligible essences only names? The answer turns, we are told, on whether mind is or is not the same thing as true opinion. If it is not, knowledge must be knowledge of essences, and therefore essences cannot be mere names. Now, mind and true opinion certainly differ, for the one is implanted by instruction, the other by persuasion. One is accompanied by true reason, the other is not. All men share in true opinion, but mind is the attribute of the gods and of a very few among men. This leads to a somewhat curious theory of space, as something intermediate between the world of essence and the world of transient sensible things. There is one kind of being which is always the same, uncreated and indestructible, never receiving anything into itself from without, nor itself going out to any other, but invisible and imperceptible by any sense, and of which the contemplation is granted to intelligence only. And there is another nature of the same name with it, and like to it, perceived by sense, created, always in motion, becoming in place and again vanishing out of place, which is apprehended by opinion and sense. And there is a third nature, which is space, and is eternal, and admits not of destruction, and provides a home for all created things, and is apprehended without the help of sense by a kind of spurious reason, and is hardly real, which we, beholding as in a dream, say of all existence that it must of necessity be in some place and occupy a space, but that what is neither in heaven nor on earth has no existence. This is a very difficult passage, which I do not pretend to understand at all fully. The theory expressed must, I think, have risen from reflection on geometry, which appeared to be a matter of pure reason, like arithmetic, and yet had to do with space, which was an aspect of the sensible world. In general, it is fanciful to find analogies with later philosophers, but I cannot help thinking that Kant must have liked this view of space as one having an affinity with his own. The true elements of the material world, Timaeus says, are not earth, air, fire, and water, but two sorts of right-angled triangles, the one which is half a square and the one which is half an equilateral triangle. Originally, everything was in confusion, and the various elements had different places before they were arranged so as to form the universe. But then God fashioned them by form and number, and made them as far as possible the fairest and best out of things which were not fair and good. The above two sorts of triangles, we are told, are the most beautiful forms, and therefore God used them in constructing matter. By means of these two triangles, it is possible to construct four of the five regular solids, and each atom of one of the four elements is a regular solid. Atoms of earth are cubes, of fire, tetrahedra, of air, octahedra, and of water, icosahedra. I shall come to the dodecahedron presently. The theory of the regular solids, which is set forth in the 13th book of Euclid, was in Plato's day a recent discovery. It was completed by Theaetetus, who appears as a very young man in the dialogue that bears his name. It was, according to tradition, he who first proved that there are only five kinds of regular solids, and discovered the octahedron and the icosahedron. The regular tetrahedron, octahedron, and icosahedron have equilateral triangles for their faces. The dodecahedron has regular pentagons and cannot therefore be constructed out of Plato's two triangles. For this reason, he does not use it in connection with the four elements. As for the dodecahedron, Plato says only, there was yet a fifth combination which God used in the delineation of the universe. This is obscure and suggests that the universe is a dodecahedron, but elsewhere it is said to be a sphere. The pentagram has always been prominent in magic and apparently owes this position to the Pythagoreans, who called it health, and used it as a symbol of recognition of members of the brotherhood. It seems that it owed its properties to the fact that the dodecahedron has pentagons for its faces and is in some sense a symbol of the universe. This topic is attractive, but it is difficult to ascertain much that is definite about it. After a discussion of sensation, Timaeus proceeds to explain the two souls in man, one immortal, the other mortal, one created by God, the other by the gods. The mortal soul is subject to terrible and irresistible affections. First of all, pleasure, the greatest incitement to evil, then pain, which deters from good, also rashness and fear, two foolish counselors, anger, hard to be appeased, and hope, easily led astray. These, they, the gods, mingled with irrational sense and with all-daring love according to necessary laws, and so framed men. The immortal soul is in the head, the mortal in the breast. There is some curious physiology, as that the purpose of the intestines is to prevent gluttony by keeping the food in, and then there is another account of transmigration. Cowardly or unrighteous men will in the next life be women. Innocent, light-minded men, who think that astronomy can be learnt by looking at the stars without knowledge of mathematics, will become birds. Those who have no philosophy will become wild land animals. The very stupidest will become fishes. The last paragraph of the dialogue sums it up. We may now say that our discourse about the nature of the universe has an end. The world has received animals, mortal and immortal, and is fulfilled with them, and has become a visible animal containing the visible. The sensible God, who is the image of the intellectual, the greatest, best, fairest, most perfect, the one only begotten heaven. It is difficult to know what to take seriously in the Timaeus, and what to regard as play of fancy. I think the account of the creation as bringing order out of chaos is to be taken quite seriously. So also is the proportion between the four elements, and their relation to the regular solids and their constituent triangles. The accounts of time and space are obviously what Plato believes, and so is the view of the created world as a copy of an eternal archetype. The mixture of necessity and purpose in the world is a belief common to practically all Greeks, long antedating the rise of philosophy. Plato accepted it and thus avoided the problem of evil, which troubles Christian theology. I think his world animal is seriously meant, but the details about transmigration and the part attributed to the gods and other inessentials are, I think, only put in to give a possible concreteness. The whole dialogue, as I said before, deserves to be studied because of its great influence on ancient and medieval thought, and this influence is not confined to what is least fantastic. Chapter 18. Knowledge and Perception in Plato. Most modern men take it for granted that empirical knowledge is dependent upon or derived from perception. There is, however, in Plato and among philosophers of certain other schools, a very different doctrine, to the effect that there is nothing worthy to be called knowledge to be derived from the senses, and that the only real knowledge has to do with concepts. In this view, 2 plus 2 equals 4 is genuine knowledge, but such a statement as snow is white is so full of ambiguity and uncertainty that it cannot find a place in the philosopher's corpus of truths. This view is perhaps traceable to Parmenides, but in its explicit form, the philosophic world owes it to Plato. I propose, in this chapter, to deal only with Plato's criticism of the view that knowledge is the same thing as perception, which occupies the first half of the Theaetetus. This dialogue is concerned to find a definition of knowledge, but ends without arriving at any but a negative conclusion. Several definitions are proposed and rejected, but no definition that is considered satisfactory is suggested. The first of the suggested definitions, and the only one that I shall consider, is set forth by Theaetetus in the words, "It seems to me that one who knows something is perceiving the thing that he knows, and, so far as I can see at present, knowledge is nothing but perception." Socrates identifies this doctrine with that of Protagoras, that man is the measure of all things, that is, that any given thing is to me such as it appears to me, and is to you such as it appears to you. Socrates adds, "Perception, then, is always something that is, and as being knowledge, it is infallible." A large part of the argument that follows is concerned with the characterization of perception. When once this is completed, it does not take long to prove that such a thing as perception has turned out to be cannot be knowledge. Socrates adds to the doctrine of Protagoras the doctrine of Heraclitus, that everything is always changing, that is, that all the things we are pleased to say are really are in the process of becoming. Plato believes this to be true of objects of sense, but not of the objects of real knowledge. Throughout the dialogue, however, his positive doctrines remain in the background. From the doctrine of Heraclitus, even if it be only applicable to objects of sense, together with the definition of knowledge as perception, it follows that knowledge is of what becomes, not of what is. There are, at this point, some puzzles of a very elementary character. We are told that since 6 is greater than 4, but less than 12, 6 is both great and small, which is a contradiction. Again, Socrates is now taller than Theaetetus, who is a youth, not yet full grown. But in a few years, Socrates will be shorter than Theaetetus. Therefore, Socrates is both tall and short. The idea of a relational proposition seems to have puzzled Plato, as it did most of the great philosophers down to Hegel, inclusive. These puzzles, however, are not very germane to the argument and may be ignored. Returning to perception, it is regarded as due to an interaction between the object and the sense organ, both of which, according to the doctrine of Heraclitus, are always changing, and both of which, in changing, change the percept. Socrates remarks that when he is well, he finds wine sweet, but when ill, sour. Here, it is a change in the percipient that causes the change in the percept. Certain objections to the doctrine of Protagoras are advanced, and some of these are subsequently withdrawn. It is urged that Protagoras ought equally to have admitted pigs and baboons are measures of all things. since they also are percipients. Questions are raised as to the validity of perception in dreams and in madness. It is suggested that if Protagoras is right, one man knows no more than another. Not only is Protagoras as wise as the gods, but what is more serious, he is no wiser than a fool. Further, if one man's judgments are as correct as another's, the people who judge that Protagoras is mistaken have the same reason to be thought right as he has. Socrates undertakes to find an answer to many of these objections, putting himself for the moment in the place of Protagoras. As for dreams, the percepts are true as percepts. As for the argument about pigs and baboons, this is dismissed as vulgar abuse. As for the argument that if each man is the measure of all things, one man is as wise as another, Socrates suggests, on behalf of Protagoras, a very interesting answer, namely that while one judgment cannot be truer than another, it can be better, in the sense of having better consequences. This suggests pragmatism. Footnote. It was presumably this passage that first suggested to F.C.S. Schiller his admiration of Protagoras. End of footnote. This answer, however, though Socrates has invented it, does not satisfy him. He urges, for example, that when a doctor foretells the course of my illness, he actually knows more of my future than I do. And when men differ as to what it is wise for the state to decree, the issue shows that some men had a greater knowledge as to the future than others had. Thus, we cannot escape the conclusion that a wise man is a better measure of things than a fool. All these are objections to the doctrine that each man is the measure of all things, and only indirectly to the doctrine that knowledge means perception, insofar as this doctrine leads to the other. There is, however, a direct argument, namely that memory must be allowed as well as perception. This is admitted, and to this extent the proposed definition is amended. We come next to criticisms of the doctrine of Heraclitus. This is first pushed to extremes in accordance, we are told, with the practice of his disciples among the bright youths of Ephesus. A thing may change in two ways, by locomotion and by a change of quality, and the doctrine of flux is held to state that everything is always changing in both respects. Footnote. It seems that neither Plato nor the dynamic youths of Ephesus had noticed that locomotion is impossible on the extreme Heraclitean doctrine. Motion demands that a given thing, A, should be now here, now there. It must remain the same thing while it moves. In the doctrine that Plato examines, there is change of quality and change of place, but not change of substance. In this respect, modern quantum physics goes further than the most extreme disciples of Heraclitus went in Plato's time. Plato would have thought this fatal to science, but it has not proved so. End of footnote. And not only is everything always undergoing some qualitative change, but everything is always changing all its qualities. So we are told, clever people think, at Ephesus. This has awkward consequences. We cannot say, this is white, for if it was white when we began speaking, it will have ceased to be white before we end our sentence. We cannot be right in saying we are seeing a thing, for seeing is perpetually changing into not seeing. Footnote. Compare the advertisement, that's shell, that was. End of footnote. If everything is changing in every kind of way, seeing has no right to be called seeing rather than not seeing, or perception to be called perception rather than not perception. And when we say perception is knowledge, we might just as well say perception is not knowledge. What the above argument amounts to is that whatever else may be in perpetual flux, the meanings of words must be fixed, at least for a time, since otherwise no assertion is definite, and no assertion is true rather than false. There must be something more or less constant, if discourse and knowledge are to be possible. This, I think, should be admitted, but a great deal of flux is compatible with this admission. There is at this point a refusal to discuss Parmenides on the ground that he is too great and grand. He is a reverend and awful figure. There was a sort of depth in him that was altogether noble. He is one being whom I respect above all. In these remarks, Plato shows his love for a static universe and his dislike of the Heraclitean flux which he has been admitting for the sake of argument. but after this expression of reverence, he abstains from developing the Parmenidean alternative to Heraclitus. We now reach Plato's final argument against the identification of knowledge with perception. He begins by pointing out that we perceive through eyes and ears rather than with them, and he goes on to point out that some of our knowledge is not connected with any sense organ. We can know, for instance, that sounds and colors are unlike, though no organ of sense can perceive both. There is no special organ for existence and non-existence, likeness and unlikeness, sameness and differences, and also unity and numbers in general. The same applies to honorable and dishonorable, and good and bad. The mind contemplates some things through its own instrumentality, others through the bodily faculties. We perceive hard and soft through touch, but it is the mind that judges that they exist and that they are contraries. Only the mind can reach existence, and we cannot reach truth if we do not reach existence. It follows that we cannot know things through the senses alone, since through the senses alone we cannot know that things exist. Therefore, knowledge consists in reflection, not in impressions. And perception is not knowledge because it has no part in apprehending truth, since it has none in apprehending existence. To disentangle what can be accepted from what must be rejected in this argument against the identification of knowledge with perception is by no means easy. There are three interconnected theses that Plato discusses, namely, 1. Knowledge is perception. 2. Man is the measure of all things. 3. Everything is in a state of flux. 1. The first of these, with which alone the argument is primarily concerned, is hardly discussed on its own account except in the final passage with which we have just been concerned. Here it is argued that comparison, knowledge of existence and understanding of number, are essential to knowledge but cannot be included in perception since they are not affected through any sense organ. The things to be said about these are different. Let us begin with likeness and unlikeness. That two shades of color, both of which I am seeing, are similar or dissimilar, as the case may be, is something which I, for my part, should accept, not indeed as a percept, but as a judgment of perception. A percept, I should say, is not knowledge, but merely something that happens, and that belongs equally to the world of physics and to the world of psychology. We naturally think of perception, as Plato does, as a relation between a percipient and an object. We say, I see a table. But here, I and table are logical constructions. The core of crude occurrence is merely certain patches of color. These are associated with images of touch. They may cause words, and they may become a source of memories. The percept, as filled out with images of touch, becomes an object, which is supposed physical. The percept, as filled out with words and memories, becomes a perception, which is part of a subject and is considered mental. The percept is just an occurrence and neither true nor false. The percept as filled out with words is a judgment and capable of truth or falsehood. This judgment I call a judgment of perception. The proposition, knowledge is perception, must be interpreted as meaning knowledge is judgments of perception. It is only in this form that it is grammatically capable of being correct. To return to likeness and unlikeness, it is quite possible when I perceive two colors simultaneously for their likeness or unlikeness to be part of the datum and to be asserted in a judgment of perception. Plato's argument that we have no sense organ for perceiving likeness and unlikeness ignores the cortex and assumes that all sense organs must be at the surface of the body. The argument for including likeness and unlikeness as possible perceptive data is as follows. Let us assume that we see two shades of color A and B, and that we judge A is like B. Let us assume further, as Plato does, that such a judgment is in general correct, and in particular is correct in the case we are considering. There is then a relation of likeness between A and B, and not merely a judgment on our part asserting likeness. If there were only our judgment, it would be an arbitrary judgment, incapable of truth or falsehood. Since it obviously is capable of truth or falsehood, the likeness can subsist between A and B and cannot be merely something mental. The judgment A is like B is true, if it is true, in virtue of a fact, just as much as the judgment A is red or A is round. The mind is no more involved in the perception of likeness than in the perception of colour. I come now to existence, on which Plato lays great stress. We have, he says, as regards sound and colour, a thought which includes both at once, namely that they exist. Existence belongs to everything, and is among the things that the mind apprehends by itself. Without reaching existence, it is impossible to reach truth. The argument against Plato here is quite different from that in the case of likeness and unlikeness. The argument here is that all that Plato says about existence is bad grammar, or rather, bad syntax. This point is important not only in connection with Plato, but also with other matters, such as the ontological argument for the existence of the deity. Suppose you say to a child, "Lions exist, but unicorns don't." You can prove your point so far as lions are concerned by taking him to the zoo and saying, "Look, that's a lion." You will not, unless you are a philosopher, add, "And you can see that that exists." If, being a philosopher, you do add this, you are uttering nonsense. To say lions exist means there are lions, that is, X is a lion, is true for a suitable X. But we cannot say of the suitable X that it exists. We can only apply this verb to a description, complete or incomplete. Lion is an incomplete description because it applies to many objects. The largest lion in the zoo is complete because it applies to only one object. Now, suppose that I am looking at a bright red patch. I may say, "This is my present percept." I may also say, "My present percept exists." But I must not say, "This exists," because the word "exists" is only significant when applied to a description as opposed to a name. Footnote: on this subject, see the last chapter of the present work. End of footnote. This disposes of existence as one of the things that the mind is aware of in objects. I come now to understanding of numbers. Here there are two very different things to be considered. On the one hand, the propositions of arithmetic, and on the other hand, empirical propositions of enumeration. 2 + 2 = 4 is of the former kind. I have 10 fingers is of the latter. I should agree with Plato that arithmetic, and pure mathematics generally, is not derived from perception. Pure mathematics consists of tautologies, analogous to "men are men," but usually more complicated. To know that a mathematical proposition is correct, we do not have to study the world, but only the meanings of the symbols. And the symbols, when we dispense with definitions, of which the purpose is merely abbreviation, are found to be such words as "or," and "not," and "all," and "some," which do not, like Socrates, denote anything in the actual world. A mathematical equation asserts that two groups of symbols have the same meaning, and so long as we confine ourselves to pure mathematics, this meaning must be one that can be understood without knowing anything about what can be perceived. Mathematical truth, therefore, is, as Plato contends, independent of perception. But it is truth of a very peculiar sort and is concerned only with symbols. Propositions of enumeration, such as "I have 10 fingers, are in quite a different category, and are obviously, at least in part, dependent on perception. Clearly, the concept "finger" is abstracted from perception, but how about the concept 10? Here we may seem to have arrived at a true universal or Platonic idea. We cannot say that 10 is abstracted from perception, for any percept which can be viewed as 10 of some kind of thing can equally well be viewed otherwise. Suppose I give the name "digitary" to all the fingers of one hand taken together. Then I can say I have 2 digitaries, and this describes the same fact of perception as I formerly described by the help of the number 10. Thus, in the statement, "I have 10 fingers, perception plays a smaller part, and conception a larger part, than in such a statement as "this is red." The matter, however, is only one of degree. The complete answer, as regards propositions in which the word 10 occurs, is that when these propositions are correctly analyzed, they are found to contain no constituent corresponding to the word 10. To explain this in the case of such a large number as 10 would be complicated. Let us therefore substitute, I have two hands. This means, there is an A, such as there is a B, such that A and B are not identical, and whatever X may be, X is a hand of mine is true when and only when X is A or X is B. Here the word two does not occur. It is true that two letters A and B occur, but we do not need to know that they are two any more than we need to know that they are black or white or whatever color they may happen to be. Thus, numbers are, in a certain precise sense, formal. The facts which verify various propositions asserting that various collections have two members have in common not a constituent, but a form. In this they differ from propositions about the Statue of Liberty, or the Moon, or George Washington. Such propositions refer to a particular portion of space-time. It is this that is in common between all the statements that can be made about the Statue of Liberty. But there is nothing in common among propositions. There are two so-and-sos, except a common form. The relation of the symbol two to the meaning of a proposition in which it occurs is far more complicated than the relation of the symbol red to the meaning of a proposition in which it occurs. We may say in a certain sense that the symbol two means nothing, for when it occurs in a true statement, there is no corresponding constituent in the meaning of the statement. We may continue if we like to say that numbers are eternal, immutable, and so on, but we must add that they are logical fictions. There is a further point. Concerning sound and color, Plato says, both together are two, and each of them is one. We have considered the two, now we must consider the one. There is here a mistake, very analogous to that concerning existence. The predicate one is not applicable to things, but only to unit classes. We can say, the earth has one satellite, but it is a syntactical error to say the moon is one. For what can such an assertion mean? You may just as well say the moon is many, since it has many parts. To say the earth has one satellite is to give a property of the concept earth-satellite, namely the following property. There is a C, such that X is a satellite of the earth, is true when and only when X is C. This is an astronomical truth, but if, for a satellite of the Earth, you substitute the Moon or any other proper name, the result is either meaningless or a mere tautology. One, therefore, is a property of certain concepts, just as 10 is a property of the concept my finger. But to argue the Earth has one satellite, namely the Moon, therefore the Moon is one, is as bad to argue the apostles were 12, Peter was an apostle, therefore Peter was 12, which would be valid if, for 12, we substituted white. The above considerations have shown that while there is a formal kind of knowledge, namely logic and mathematics, which is not derived from perception, Plato's arguments as regards all other knowledge are fallacious. This does not, of course, prove that his conclusion is false. It proves only that he has given no valid reason for supposing it true. 2. I come now to the position of Protagoras, that man is the measure of all things, or, as it is interpreted, that each man is the measure of all things. Here, it is essential to decide the level upon which the discussion is to proceed. It is obvious that, to begin with, we must distinguish between percepts and inferences. Among percepts, each man is inevitably confined to his own. What he knows of the percepts of others, he knows by inference from his own percepts in hearing and reading. The percepts of dreamers and madmen, as percepts, are just as good as those of others. The only objection to them is that as their context is unusual, they are apt to give rise to fallacious inferences. But how about inferences? Are they equally personal and private? In a sense, we must admit that they are. What I am to believe, I must believe because of some reason that appeals to me. It is true that my reason may be someone else's assertion, but that may be a perfectly adequate reason, for instance, if I am a judge listening to evidence. And however Protagorean I may be, it is reasonable to accept the opinion of an accountant about a set of figures, in preference to my own, for I may have repeatedly found that if at first I disagree with him, a little more care shows me that he was right. In this sense, I may admit that another man is wiser than I am. The Protagorean position, rightly interpreted, does not involve the view that I never make mistakes, but only that the evidence of my mistakes must appear to me. My past self can be judged just as another person can be judged, but all this presupposes that as regards inferences as opposed to percepts, there is some impersonal standard of correctness. If any inference that I happen to draw is just as good as any other, then the intellectual anarchy that Plato deduces from Pythagoras does in fact follow. On this point, therefore, which is an important one, Plato seems to be in the right. But the empiricist would say that perceptions are the test of correctness in inference in empirical material. 3. The doctrine of universal flux is caricatured by Plato, and it is difficult to suppose that anyone ever held it in the extreme form that he gives to it. Let us suppose, for example, that the colors we see are continually changing. Such a word as red applies to many shades of color, and if we say, I see red, there is no reason why this should not remain true throughout the time that it takes to say it. Plato gets his results by applying to processes of continuous change such logical oppositions as perceiving and not perceiving, knowing and not knowing. Such oppositions, however, are not suitable for describing such processes. Suppose on a foggy day you watch a man walking away from you along a road. He grows dimmer and dimmer, and there comes a moment when you are sure that you no longer see him, but there is an intermediate period of doubt. Logical oppositions have been invented for our convenience, but continuous change requires a quantitative apparatus, the possibility of which Plato ignores. What he says on this subject, therefore, is largely beside the mark. At the same time, it must be admitted that unless words to some extent had fixed meanings, discourse would be impossible. Here again, however, it is easy to be too absolute. Words do change their meanings. Take, for example, the word idea. It is only by a considerable process of education that we learn to give to this word something like the meaning which Plato gave to it. It is necessary that the changes in the meanings of words should be slower than the changes that the words describe. But it is not necessary that there should be no changes in the meanings of words. Perhaps this does not apply to the abstract words of logic and mathematics, but these words, as we have seen, apply only to the form, not to the matter, of propositions. Here again we find that logic and mathematics are peculiar. Plato, under the influence of the Pythagoreans, assimilated other knowledge too much to mathematics. He shared this mistake with many of the greatest philosophers, but it was a mistake nonetheless. Chapter 19. Aristotle's Metaphysics. In reading any important philosopher, but most of all in reading Aristotle, it is necessary to study him in two ways, with reference to his predecessors and with reference to his successors. In the former aspect, Aristotle's merits are enormous. In the latter, his demerits are equally enormous. For his demerits, however, his successors are more responsible than he is. He came at the end of the creative period in Greek thought, and after his death it was 2,000 years before the world produced any philosopher who could be regarded as approximately his equal. Towards the end of this long period, his authority had become almost as unquestioned as that of the Church, and in science, as well as in philosophy, he had become a serious obstacle to progress. Ever since the beginning of the 17th century, almost every serious intellectual advance has had to begin with an attack on some Aristotelian doctrine. In logic, this is still true at the present day. But it would have been at least as disastrous if any of his predecessors, except perhaps Democritus, had acquired equal authority. To do him justice, we must, to begin with, forget his excessive posthumous fame and the equally excessive posthumous condemnation to which it led. Aristotle was born, probably in 384 BC, at Stagira in Thrace. His father had inherited the position of family physician to the king of Macedonia. At about the age of 18, Aristotle came to Athens and became a pupil of Plato. He remained in the academy for nearly 20 years until the death of Plato in 348 to 7 BC. He then traveled for a time and married either the sister or the niece of a tyrant named Hermias. Scandal said she was the daughter or concubine of Hermias, but both stories are disproved by the fact that he was a eunuch. In 343 BC, he became tutor to Alexander, then 13 years old, and continued in that position until, at the age of 16, Alexander was pronounced by his father to be of age and was appointed regent during Philip's absence. Everything one would wish to know of the relations of Aristotle and Alexander is unascertainable, the more so as legends were soon invented on the subject. There are letters between them which are generally regarded as forgeries. People who admire both men suppose that the tutor influenced the pupil. Hegel thinks that Alexander's career shows the practical usefulness of philosophy. As to this, A.W. Benn says, "It would be unfortunate if philosophy had no better testimonial to show for herself than the character of Alexander. Arrogant, drunken, cruel, vindictive, and grossly superstitious, he united the vices of a Highland chieftain to the frenzy of an Oriental despot." For my part, while I agree with Ben about the character of Alexander, I nevertheless think that his work was enormously important and enormously beneficial, since, but for him, the whole tradition of Hellenic civilization might well have perished. As to Aristotle's influence on him, we are left free to conjecture whatever seems to us most plausible. For my part, I should suppose it nil. Alexander was an ambitious and passionate boy, on bad terms with his father, and presumably impatient of schooling. Aristotle thought no state should have as many as 100,000 citizens, and preached the doctrine of the golden mean. I cannot imagine his pupil regarding him as anything but a prosy old pedant, set over him by his father to keep him out of mischief. Alexander, it is true, had a certain snobbish respect for Athenian civilization, but this was common to his whole dynasty, who wished to prove that they were not barbarians. It was analogous to the feeling of 19th-century Russian aristocrats for Paris. This, therefore, was not attributable to Aristotle's influence, and I do not see anything else in Alexander that could possibly have come from this source. It is more surprising that Alexander had so little influence on Aristotle, whose speculations on politics were blandly oblivious of the fact that the era of city-states had given way to the era of empires.